2nd Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm in the Nordale Hotel with Mr. Dan Newman, and he will give us a little talk. This is for Pioneer Igloo number 4, with the Pioneers of Alaska.
My name is Dan Noonan by what everybody calls me. My Christian name was really not Dan. My Christian name was Dominic. And my initial Aloysius, and then the word Noonan gave D-A-N. So even my mother called me Dan after an uncle that she wanted to name me for, who was Dan. Instead of that, my father insisted on naming me after one of his brothers, who was named Dominic. But however, everybody in Alaska knows me as Dan Noonan. And we spell that name N-O-O-N-A-N. A lot of people think of Newman, Newlin, have different variations, but it's not. It's Dan Noonan. N-O-O-N-A-N, Noon. Like they say noon and night, you know, to get the idea on the noon. Well, I was born in Philadelphia in 1883, October 23rd, 1883, so I'm now in my 77th year. I first came to Alaska, not intending to stay. I finished school at a place, Villanova University in Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia. And I graduated there in 1904. Well, at that time, I had an uncle who was in here in Fairbanks. So I thought it'd be nice if I'd come out and give him a surprise because we hadn't heard of him from the first time he came to Alaska, except we knew he was in Fairbanks. So I came up here and I found out he was here and he had been fire chief. Now that was the Uncle Dan that I was supposed to be named after. So I spent that summer here, and of course it was very hectic because 1904, Fairbanks was really, you might say, at its height. The town was active, there were a number of people, everything was more or less hectic. And a great deal different what it is today, because the old town, you know, most of tent city and growing up like Topsy, there was no town plan or anything, and there was no such thing as paved streets. Very few were even planks, just left the natural earth. But little by little, I've seen the town grow because I returned to Alaska then and really entered Alaska, you might say, to stay in 1908. Now, incidentally, that year 1904, when I came here, that was my 21st birthday. So I consider that as kind of a little, exactly like a little festival idea to spend my 21st birthday in Fairbanks, Alaska. So Etras, that's quite proud of that, although at that time I didn't give it a thought. But identifies my year, and I come here, my 21st birthday, graduating from school, and with all the ideas a young fella has, you know. So it has changed a lot. But however, I worked for the NC Company on the Yukon River boats from 1908 through 1913, when the Floss interests, who were the dominating financial power behind the NC Company, sold out to the White Pass. Then the stores disintegrated too, and they were in the hand of individuals. But finally, my old boss, Bonnie Richmond Sr., reorganized the company, and that is, comes down today. His son, Bonnie Richmond Jr., practically the head of the corporation. But it's kind of a long story to go over those things, and I really wouldn't know what to say to the old pioneers, because those fellows stayed in the country, and they really did some work and digging and mucking and all that kind of stuff that I never did do. Because when I came back in 1908 and worked on the transportation company with the boats on the Yukon River, I was chief steward on the Swatka and the St. Michael and on the Susie, where I ended up. I was 3 years on the Susie. But I took any job could be had, you know. I was night watchman on the Swatka. I was waiter.
Remember the names of some of the crew and captains that you worked with?
Yes, there was the Captain Orrin J. Newcomb was the captain of the Susie. Captain John Cann was captain on the St. Michael. And Captain, I'm trying to think of some of the names that were only there for maybe a trip, Captain Green. Now there was two Greens. Captain, I think one was named Tom, one named Jack. Now I can't just recall whether it was Tom Green or Jack Green that I was with on the Swatka. And at the same time, his chief steward there, the regular chief steward, was also named Green. And Captain was Green. And I was only there to take the boat up the river till such time as the steward could call it, and then I was transferred to the steamer Swatka. Now on the steamer Swatka, there was Captain Looney, who was only there for a couple of trips till his boat came out of the water. He was the regular captain on the steamer Sarah, one of the packets. But finally, why, in 1910, I was made chief steward on the Susie, under Captain Orrin J. Newcomb, and Ralph Newcomb, his son, was one of the pilots. And Ralph is still living in Seattle today. He's come up here till late years and worked for BRAC on this BRAC transportation company here in Fairbanks. But little by little, why, naturally you lose track of these men and the names stick on your tongue. There was Captain Sam Lancaster, for instance, was on the Louise. Captain Gray was on the Town Hall, running from the little town at the Town Hall, Fort Gibbon, whatever you want to call it, to Fairbanks. And he was quite proud of his boat. He had to weigh everything that came aboard because he claimed he could take a ship over a Mountain Dew and reach Fairbanks because the ship only drew a couple of feet of water. So he used to weigh every sack of potatoes or every sack of sugar, everything you had at steward stores, and sometimes he would leave some behind, he wouldn't take them on, and of course that didn't sit well with the chief steward.
Was you on the boat when they had to use the walking beams lots of time to get over bar?
Oh yes, that was a common practice. Whenever you hit a bar, they put these big spars out, you know, and turn the ship around and keep the stern wheel in motion and wash the bar away, and then lift the boat on these spars, mm-hmm. little hydraulic wrench, you know, mm-hmm. and finally get over. And proceed on the way. But even worse than that is going through places like Sagamuff Slough down on the Lower River. Lots of times there'd be more water in the slough than there was in the main river. So in going through the slough where the erosion was taking place, sometimes you find trees in front of the boat and you couldn't proceed till they washed those old tree trunks away. Then they'd do the same procedure, turn the stern wheel against the bank, keep the machinery going, and wash away part of the bank in order to get past these fallen trees.
Were they all wood burners in those days?
All wood burners. The Susie and the packets were the first one to become oil burners. And that didn't take place till about 1910 or 11. But there was a wood camp every so many miles, and all passengers and crew would all start and take part in carrying the wood aboard the ship. And we were paid a little extra for that outside our monthly pay. My monthly pay as a night watchman was $60 a month. That's what you call a contract man. Now a man who wasn't contract just find his own way in the country and then join the boat, he got $15 extra. He got $75 a month. But we would sign on in San Francisco as a company employee, and they paid our transportation all the way up to our station and also take us out again in the fall. But from 1909 till 1912 I stayed right in Alaska. And I was over in charge of the mess house here in the slough in the winter of 1910. Then I was in charge of the mess house of St. Michael the winter of 1911. So that gave me two fine winters to be right here in the territory without taking advantage of the company's fare to send me all the way back to San Francisco. Because that was quite a process, and there was a lot of camaraderie among the crews. The same crew this year would come back next year, with very few changes. And a good many of them had nicknames, like Circus Jack Ridgway, who was in charge of stores of St. Michael. And our port steward there named Joe Sanguinetti, and our port captain, Captain McNoble. Well, I remember all those names because they stick with you. But there's lots of other men. Now, for instance, Joe Matthews was chief engineer for the boats, and he did a lot of pioneering work in Alaska, too. Joe Matthews was really one of the old genuine pioneers.
You did fishing and mining, too?
Well, a little bit. I staked out at Ruby, and I staked at Marshall in 1912, but nothing comes from that. I was just in case you might be lucky, as a member of the crew on the boat, you know, and we'd all get out and they stake a claim. You're allowed two claims yourself and two powers of attorney. Now, Ralph Newcomb and I, we both staked at Marshall. And however, nothing came of my claims. I don't think Ralph made anything out of his either. But that was just incidental. In case you did strike something, you can't compare yourself in that way and call yourself a miner, you know.
Do you know some of the history of Mr. Nordell and some of the first hotels
here? Yes, old Tony Nordell had the first hotel was over close on the river, on the riverbank. That is on that street that's now facing the river. Well, that hotel burned down in 1913. I believe that was the year. Then they built this new place, and I didn't see this new hotel until later years when I came back here in 1935 as a salesman. That was my first time at the hotel as it is today. Of course, right now you see they've remodeled and dialed it up a lot too. But however, it was always a very satisfactory place, and this one family that certainly did take care of their guests. And old Tony himself was quite a fine old man, an original character. There was quite a few in Fairbanks at that time. Say, men like Charlie Maine. I don't know whether you know Charlie Maine.
Yes, I know.
And of course, they built the Tanmore Railroad, as you call it, and there's men here like Leroy Tozer. Some of those names come back to me, you see. And of course, Judge Wickersham. And I can't think of one, and then John McGinn.
New Pedro, too.
Yes, well, I didn't know him personally, but I have seen him on the streets. But at that time, as I say, I never expect to stay around this country this long, and I didn't pay too much attention to
John
him.
McGinn, too.
You know John, yeah. Well, John was here and lived out of this hotel for quite a while. But it's pretty hard to get back over those cases, because the Schlossenders that owned the NC Company at that time, Vonnie Richmond was vice president, and he was my immediate boss for that matter. Then there was a man named Taylor, I can't think of Taylor's first name, and there was Charlie Grimm, the auditor. We call them the Royal Family.
I heard their names.
See, when they traveled down one of the boats, we had a special room for them, and special table.
Everybody was special.
All this and that. Well, everybody was special. The NC made no distinction among their guests riding on the boats or their passengers. Everybody got the same food. But there would be time you might have a special guest when the captain would ask, well, say, can we cook up a fried chicken for so-and-so and so-and-so, mm-hmm. See? But whenever they did that, as a rule, I had to put that on the bill of fare for everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I get out of that. I remember one time we got some strawberries down at St. Michael, and the captain wanted them reserved for his table, as he called it. Mm-hmm. So first day, the first dinner we out, I put a dish of strawberries at every plate on the boat. And we got rid of the two crates of strawberries all at once. So that ended that question about just having them for special guests. But one of the real experiences I can remember that way, we had I'm trying to think of this lad's name, he was their agent at Mulatto. I'll think of his name in a minute, it'll come to me. But anyhow, he came down to St. Michael on some sort of a case for the company, and where he had an interview with the auditor who was stationed at the St. Michael at that time. And there happened to be a young girl come up on the Victoria, expecting to meet her intended husband, to meet her when the boat arrived. Well, she arrived all right, but there was no husband in prospect. So we had a dance at a place over there, a place called Moser's. They had a little place of binge and a mannered bar because St. Michael was dry on account of the troops and the natives. But however, we had this dance over at Moser's place, and I introduced this agent to this young lady that was looking for this husband. So I just said to him in a joke, I said, I hope that husband don't come. Here's a good girl for you. So now you're an express agent up there in Nulada, you're NC Company, you're just for peace, and with all these jobs, what you need is a wife. She's a single, you know. So by golly, it happened that way, by golly, when her husband didn't appear to come down river, although the boat was late. Two boats did come down river, and he wasn't on, but one passenger, she made inquiries from the ship's pursers. They said, yes, that man left Fairbanks. He's someplace in the States. He left there somewhere under a cloud. He had some court case, and he just skipped out.
Uh-oh.
So, of course, that left her high and dry. She had no money to return to the States. So this I'm trying to think of his name. Anyhow, he married her right there in the St. Michael. Mm-hmm. Judge Flynn would perform the ceremony. Mm-hmm. And old Judge Flynn was quite a character, too. He left the St. Michael. He was with the old NAT&T company with the Haley Hotel. And see, the NC company afterwards absorbed the NAT company, North American Trading and Transportation Company. And Judge Flynn was their agent at St. Michael. And this man, Haley, was the head of the company, and they named the hotel there the Haley Hotel. As the NC Hotel was called the Northern Commercial Hotel. But the NC Company, the boats were really the NC property, but they had a house flag, NN Company, Northern Navigation Company. But everybody identified them, you know, as an NC subsidiary.
I remember that flag.
Yeah, the NAT&T Company, and it was absorbed by the NN Company. And one by one, naturally, the river boats went out after the railroad was built. Why, there's no such thing as the traffic on the river to any extent. So if that thing hadn't happened, the chances are the conditions remained as they were, I might still be coming working on the Yukon River boats.
You might never left.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, I was outside, I got married, and of course that changed the course of my life, and I worked on the ocean steamers for quite a while before I finally left them in 1930 and cover the salesman territory as a salesman.
Do you remember some about the Chena village down here below Fairbanks?
Well, we never got down to Chena as far as the stopping place. The stopping place, I only made a few trips into Fairbanks because my boats were on the main river from St. Michael to Dawson.
They covered the whole
river. But only occasionally we came up to Fairbanks. I came up to Fairbanks on the steamer St. Michael at one trip, but we came direct to Fairbanks. We didn't stop at Chena. And I didn't know whether there's a river landing at Chena, as far as I know.
How about Nenana?
Nenana, yes, Nenana was the regular stop for the Nenana River boat. That's Captain Gray's boat called the Tananaw.
What kind of town was it?
Well, Nenana was quite a little town. It was a good settlement there. It wasn't big in the sense of Fairbanks, but I guess it had about 1,500 people and a lot of prospecting going on out of that region. It was a prosperous little town. But Captain Gray, they stopped at places like Hot Springs, you know, Manly Hot Springs. And I don't know, I don't remember all the landings on the Tananaw. I can remember the landings on the Yukon.
And Squaw Crossing and all those places, you made all those?
Well, the Tananaw Crossing was further up. The boat didn't go that far.
Oh.
Only on occasional trips they went up to Fires Tanacross.
Oh.
But there was a trader up there, Tetlin. Tetlin is up near Tanacross. And there's a trader up there who used to receive his merchandise at Nenana, then take it up on his own boat.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of that trader's name, a little Jewish fellow, but he was all right. He was quite a good operator. But down the Yukon River, we had landings in like, places like Birch's. You know, there's, don't hear of much today. Of course, we had larger places like Circle, Rampart, Tananaw, or we call it Fort Gibbon, also called Ware.
Did you go up into Dawson through the rapids, too, on your trips?
Well, yes, coming down from Whitehorse, go through the Whitehorse Rapids and come down through Five Fingers to get into Dawson. But there's no rapids right at Dawson.
Do you remember any exciting problems you had on those trips?
Yes, in some ways, there were some few instances took place. We had a man named Irwin was marshal here at Fairbanks, and he came down the river on the steamer Tananaw in charge of a corpse as well as some criminals. So had live ones and dead ones, and whatever you want to say in that regard. But when we joined the Susie, he got up a poker game with some of the other prominent pastors, and there was couldn't play in the dining room because every table was taken. So they went down on the lower deck, and they put a couple of blankets over this icebox, and they played poker out on top of the corpse. Well, that was kind of a little instance, you know, to talk about. Now, Marshall Irwin was here for some years. And the mayor of Quayle had the mayor of Fairbanks at that time was Fred Carter. Fred Carter was the mayor, and his wife after was down and had good ground and did a lot, Mrs. Fred Carter, and she ended up, I believe, in Anchorage as a resident there and died in Anchorage. But I don't know what became of Fred. But Fred Carter was the mayor, and names would come to me, but I can't think of their name unless they are mentioned. Then you can recall certain little circumstances, you know.
Do you remember a businessman here?
Yes, Mr. Fowle was a customer of mine. Mr. Fowle had a nice business. He sold out about 1935 or 36, around about that time, liquidated his stock, and then went out further where he had a little home and used a truck and take a little merchandise around to the creeks.
He did something like Max Reedy did out of Fox.
Max had a fixture at Fox. Max stayed right at Fox.
Yeah, but he'd come in town and deliver groceries.
Oh, yes, he'd come in town and also buy groceries.
Mm-hmm.
He'd buy stuff like he had an order out at Fox, and he wanted maybe an overcoat or something to come and get it in one of these towns because he couldn't afford to stock clothing to that extent. But he did stock some staple things like heavy work socks, heavy underwear. You know, that was staple. But if anybody wanted a Stetson hat or something, then he'd come into town and he patronized old, fellow on the waterfront here, Abe Simpson.
Abe Simpson.
Old Abe Simpson had a place on the waterfront, see?
That's right.
Well, I don't know what become of Abe or how where he died or anything, but some years later, his nephew, Alex Simpson, came up and tried to resuscitate the business when the boom came on, but he actually was moved down to Anchorage and had a nice business of Anchorage. But Brick Jacobs, however, worked for Abe Simpson, and he started Brick Shop
on
Christmas Street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he first favored the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
But when the fire came and burned him out, he moved around where they put up the new building, and he rented from the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he really didn't want to, Brick didn't really want to rent from the bank. He wanted to come over here, and there's a vacant store right by the Nordell Hotel here. The address was taken up by Dennis Godzilla and Bernie Carr.
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, he wanted to go into that location, but he's afraid if he changed his location, he wouldn't get a loan from the bank. So Vic told me, I said, Vic, the way you're sitting, you've got to take the loan from the bank and open your store in their building. What else are you going to do? So that's the way he did it, finally. But however, he made a good business there, and he had a wonderful store. I think a fellow named Lively bought him out there. Mm-hmm. And then after Lively, a fellow named Sachs. And I don't know who owns the store now. I was over there the other day, and I see some new hands. I expect to see Bob Sachs, and they told me he left here about 3 years ago, and that's something I didn't know.
Right.
Something I didn't know. But I think I've known practically all the merchants in Fairbanks, especially the ones I did business with. But then when there were no airplanes to travel, they had to travel on the boat. You got to know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I knew every trader down the Yukon River. Say like Jim Atkinson at Caltag, Charlie Sellers at Circle, Rodman at Tananaw, Mickey Woods at Tananaw, Charlie Trigger at St. Michael and Unalakleet, and Williams up on Hot Springs and Tananaw. So you got to know everybody because the boats was the only way they could travel. We had no highway. We had no airplanes, and that all came in later years. But you not only do the merchants, but you got to know the people because the ordinary residents also travel in and out on the boats. Some would go up away at St. Michael, some would go up away at Dawson and Skagway.
You never stayed over too many winters here, so you'd learn about the freighters and the mail carriers?
Oh, yes, yes. I know them. Charlie Sage was one of the mail carriers, and a fellow named Randall had the mail contract for the Lower Yukon River.
Dog teams.
But between here and when they opened the Richland Highway, I don't know just what year that was, but Bob Sheldon, who still is here,
mm-hmm.
Bob went over that route. And in later years, of course, I knew most all the truckers when I started to sell up in the territory as a salesman. So I traveled mostly with Dick Zender.
Oh, yeah.
And with Johnny Clark,
mm-hmm.
and with young Miller,
mm-hmm.
and those names come back to me in a way. So I have known quite a variety of the different people and different merchants. Mr. Barrick of the Samson Hardware Company. And one character was Bob Bloom.
Bob Bloom, yeah.
Now
he
Bob.
I remember.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, Bob had a store on Front Street there, facing the river. And in later years, Bob was getting old. He didn't give a damn for business, you know, as far as that's concerned. But he just kept his place, and he had all the old merchandise that he had in the early days, including the big horse collar. Yeah, and he had a couple of bathtubs in there. And out of some barber went out, he bought the barber chair, and that was his throne. He'd sit on that barber chair, and his customers come in, they'd say, hello, Bob, and he'd say, hello, Charlie, or whatever it was. And then he'd go tell him to help himself, tell him what they were looking for was. And he would leave that darn old chair.
Mm-hmm.
Then finally he'd get up and walk over and wait on the train. He was, you know, kind of easing off. His Bob was getting old, quite a character. I was in there one day, and a fellow walks in the store, and it was late in the afternoon, gets dark early, say about 3 or 4 o'clock, and they had one little light. Otherwise, the store was dark.
Mm-hmm.
So Bob was sitting in his chair, in a barber chair, and I walked right over to him, shook hands, said, hello, Bob, and hello, Dad, and this and that. We passed a little conversation. And it was cold, and when the door would open, the blast of wind would come in. So this old-timer came in from the old Yukon River where he had a wood camp. And I can't think of his name, but he came in anyhow, and he looks around, and he didn't see Bob in the chair, and he says, is anybody home here? You know, kind of an accented voice to me. That's where Bob Bloom is sitting here in this chair. Oh, he said, that's who I want to see. So I walked over, and he says, hello, Bob. And Bob, whatever his name was, I don't recall. He says, hello, Charlie. And he says, Bob, he says, I've been quite a while. I've never been in Fairbanks lately, but I've been called up by the court. And this is the first time I've been on about 16 years.
Now we're on, Dan.
Now where was I? I was talking about Bob Bloom. Well, anyhow, this man comes in and he asks Bob. He said, Bob, he said, I haven't been here for a long time till they call me up to court as a witness. And he said, I remember I owe you a bill. So Bob gets down off his chair and he has a big wire hoop all as big as a wagon wheel. And on that hoop, he had all these old recipes or receipts of unpaid bills. So he thumbs through this thing, and he finally pulls one off, and he says, "Well, Joe," whatever his name was, and looks at it, he says, "You owe me, if I recall right, it was $17 and some cents." So Joe digs into his pocket, he bills Bob a $20 bill. He says, "Bob, you keep the change," he said, "because I think you ought to charge me interest on that." Bob said, "I ought to charge you double interest, Charlie. You know, it's 18 years since you wrote up this bill." He said, "I never charge anything off, though." He said, "I always keep them because sooner or later, these people come in, they pay me." Mm-hmm. So they bid each other good day, and out they went, out this fellow went. Well, I thought that was quite amusing and showing a man's character. But Bob's one of his daughters, I think, became principal one of the schools here. And Bob was a Florian himself, what we would call an Irish Dublin Jew. Mm-hmm. But his daughter became one of the, I think she was principal of the high school, I'm not sure. But they sent all his daughters to Dublin to be educated.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And later years I saw Bob when this Jew was elected Lord Mayor of Dublin. I said, "Bob," he says, "well, if I stayed there, maybe they'd elect me Lord Mayor." Yeah, I don't know where Bob is living. I haven't seen him.
He's in Fairbanks.
You mean he's in Fairbanks now?
Yeah, I talked to him the other day. He said, "Me bring the recorder over and he'll..." He's living right over here behind, in his old house, behind the Sardo Express office,
uh-huh.
Right behind the hotel here.
Well, if he's here, you get him to verify that little story about this fellow paying the old bill for such a long time, and he was called up here to a court as a witness for some case having to do between a white man and a squaw.
That's his to tell me.
Yeah, and maybe he'll tell you. He may have more detail than just my memory that way. But there's another character here, too, as a real man, was Charlie Maine.
Charlie Maine, yes.
Now, Charlie Maine was a real honest-to-God sourdough and all that, all a pioneer. Charlie used to go out every winter and get his moose.
Mm-hmm.
And I came here one time, and Charlie invited me over to a moose dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And when he served the big moose steak, it had the hair on it. He didn't dehydrate it, but he just kept his big piece off the rump and cooked it up. It was fine. It was all right. It was, but that was Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
When he went to his store and these stuff was piled up on the floor, you know, any old place, and you wonder how he did business. But geez, he had a lot of old stuff in there, you know, old furs and parkies.
He has very good memory.
Rifles, and he had a little bit of everything. He called it, and I think he built a hotel here, this Deluxe Hotel. Wasn't that Charlie Maine?
Right next to him, yeah.
Yeah, I think I was, mm-hmm. Well, he moved to that store later.
Oh.
See, he was further down on the riverfront.
No, I see.
About 4 or 5 blocks down on the riverfront side,
mm-hmm.
where he had his original store.
Mm-hmm.
But when he moved up to the other store, it was just as congested with merchandise, and he, whether you wanted a needle or whether you wanted a rifle, Charlie had it.
It was right up to the end,
yes.
When he left you. I knew Charlie.
Yeah, you knew Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was quite a man.
Joe Burns has that
That's right.
Now.
Well, then, of course, at the NC Company, there's men like George Preston, you know, all those years. I've been very fond about George. And here recently, you know, I made a trip to Africa. And when I got to Cape Town, I received a letter from my daughter telling me that George Preston's son was in Seattle. When he heard I was going to South Africa, he wanted me to meet his cousins there. Mm-hmm. And he gave addresses. Well, the letter reached me just in time. I was just about to take a plane to go up to Johannesburg. So when I got that letter, I stayed over and made my reservation at the hotel and looked this man up. And his name is George Preston Wallace, named after George Preston here. Well, he had a wonderful business, wonderful home, and everything on a division called Rondebosch Cape Town. So we went out and we had dinner, and we went to his club, one of those old English state clubs, you know, and we had a fine lunch. So then the next day I took him out to dinner and his wife, and he had a boy, a son and a daughter, both wonderful people. Well, then from there I went on up to Johannesburg and met his other brother, John, who was in charge of a big clothing store in Johannesburg, the largest store there. It's not a department store, just a men's clothing store, but very large and very efficient, had wonderful stock, and I was surprised to see some American goods in there, like Stetson hats and interwoven socks, some of the merchandise that I sold here in Alaska. And I was surprised to see that they were exported down to the Union of South Africa. Running the same experience further on, a place called Rinko Marks, and saw Tuval shirts, you know, made in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised to see the American merchandise, because on this buying from the, what they call the silver sterling countries, they weren't allowed to spend their money in the dollar countries like the United States. But now that restriction's off, and I understand now that they're exporting quite a lot of American merchandise to South Africa. Well, that was a wonderful trip, and now meeting the Wallace boys down there, I had made it kind of interesting to, from a Fairbanks standpoint, understand that George Press himself is out now, and I won't be able to see him. That's but I will see the son here, and tell him about
Charlie.
That.
Charlie's here, Deb is down at Kodiak.
Yeah, at Kodiak, huh?
Yeah,
but I'm going down to Kodiak.
He lives out of Fairbanks. I think you'll find him at Kodiak or Homer, one of the two.
Well, I'm going down to both Kodiak and Homer, and I may bear that in mind and make a note of it.
Charlie is here, yeah.
Look him up. Well, I'll see
Charlie.
And
Rowan Lively, his wife, is one of the Preston.
Yeah, she's one of the daughters.
Still here too. Yeah.
She's one of the daughters. Yeah. Well, I'll see Rowley. I know Rowley's here, so I'll see him.
You know where he lives, do you, Don?
No, I don't know where he lives, but I'll get in touch with him anyhow. Because some of those men are associated with you. Rowley was one of my pretty good customers because he worked first for the NC, then was transferred and made manager of the Anchorage operation, then came up here and bought Brick's Jacob's store. So Rowley was a customer of mine. He bought quite a lot.
The last few years, Lively has been civil defense director here for the last 7 or 8 years, and he's just been replaced.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. My present trip to Fairbanks now is not much to do with selling merchandise, although I'm taking on the old lines I had here. I'm not looking for a commercial here, but after I left, when you don't make calls, you don't get reorders. So consequently, the business fell off, and the firm asked me, as long as I was making this trip to Alaska, to do a little work for them, which I'll do, and try to get another salesman that I can recommend to them to cover the territory. A younger man if I can. And one who got some sales ability and is willing to get out and work. Because when you're a salesman, you got to work. You can't let it come to you. You can't wait for your customer to come to you. No matter what you're selling, you must go and look for business.
Do you remember Dewey Mitzdorf?
Dewey quite well, because Dewey was...
Old man Cummings?
Cummings had the hotel, and then Dewey bought in with him, and he died, and then Dewey had it to himself. But Dewey was first with the commissary of the railroad. And from the commissary of the railroad, where he took over the hotel with Cummings, from Reed, a man named Reed owned that hotel and built it. Mr. Reed from Nome built that hotel. But Dewey now, I think, is down at Palm Springs, California, and the Western Hotels, the company that he's with, has bought this Western Hotel in Anchorage and the Anchorage Hotel and combined them in one big operation.
I understand Dewey turned all his assets in for stock in the company.
He did.
He receives a salary.
That's right, he did. He was manager of the Washington Hotel in Seattle for some years before they sent him to Palm Beach. But he's with that company now, I don't know how long it is, at least maybe 10 or 15 years. So he's coming right along, and one of his sons also manager of one of the hotels.
Right after the war, he left here. Because I had worked for him down there right after I worked here in town.
I see. Well, his son is manager now of the Roosevelt Hotel. That's one of the hotels in Seattle, too.
That's how I come to be wrestling you fellows' luggage all the time.
I see. Well, I wouldn't recall that until you mentioned it to me, because with this little mustache and stuff, my dress changed, and the glasses,
I didn't have these either.
Well, I got the same thing. So when you remembered me and spoke to me, I consider it kind of a compliment that you remember me that long.
I'd love to see you,
too. I know that. I appreciate that. And I've met several people here today, and I think I'll engage Eva as one of my publicity agents.
Eva
McGowan.
Her office is right over here off of
that's
Valley
right.
now.
Well,
right
I bumped,
across from the Chamber
that's
County.
Right. Well, I bumped into three or four places yesterday. I walked in the model to eat, and I heard from the booth, I was saying to somebody, do you know Dan Noonan's here? So I walked down there with Eva. So I said, Eva, by golly, I'll give you a chance. I'll maybe engage you as a publicity agent.
Well, I'm sure the pioneers will be glad to see you too, Dan, and they'll get an opportunity eventually to hear this tape.
Well, while I'm here, then I'll tell them one little thing. When I'm in Sitka, I generally go to the pioneers' home and see some of the old-timers there,
that's
you know.
That's appreciated, too.
And there was one or two men from Fairbanks there at the time, but a woman named Miss Rowe was the nurse in Juneau, and was taking one of the old-timers. I don't know whether he's from Fairbanks or where he was from. But when they took him over to the home, this nurse was assigned to him to get him ready for the doctors. So they stripped him down and began to get right down to bedrock. Why, she saw that the poor old fellow needed the bath. So she said to him, she says, my dear man, don't you ever take a bath? He looks up at her and he says, well, my dear woman, he says, I was never in the hospital before.
You never took a bath, huh?
I was never in the hospital before. Well, that would be something for the pioneers to know and have a little laugh over and chuckle. I don't know the old fellow's name. I just heard that story while I was there from a man named Ina Hansen, who was superintendent at the time. But I was a handsome out, and then I had a fellow named Bill Knight, who was very good to the pioneers, and then Mr. Leslie Yaw. So I don't know who's there now, because that's a political job, changes, you know, in administrations. But Ted Kettleson, an old Fairbanks man, was also superintendent of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Kettleson, believe me, he and his wife, they just booked those pioneers as their children. And nobody could have taken better care of those men than Mrs. Kettleson. Mm-hmm. They were really wonderful people. But however, it was a political job. And,
mm-hmm.
But Ted invested there, and he owns a nice building there, and the bank is in his building.
Mm-hmm.
He has some rooms, and, you know, upstairs, and the four rentals on the ground floor. So he made a good investment. And I think he still holds, as far as I know, although he lives in California. But Ted must be getting up in years now. He was a good friend of Carl Thiel's.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Thiel, another old Fairbanks man who had prospects away down Aniak and different prospects around different parts of the country. And he was made Secretary of Alaska under Governor Bone.
Governor Scott C. Bone.
Carl Thiel was the title then was Surveyor General and Secretary of Alaska. Now they've changed that, and the present man, New Wade, is called Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, when the governor was absent, Carl Thiel was acting governor,
mm-hmm.
the next man to the governor. And Carl was a fine big fellow, the husky lad, but he died prematurely. But his widow still lives in Juneau, and I'm working for the government there. She was one of the government clerks when they were married. So there's lots of names that could come up and lots of ways I know. I believe Carl was a member of the number four igloo of the pioneers. I'm not sure of that, but I think he was. I know Ted Kettleson was. So all these old timers would know Ted Kettleson.
Okay. Now who do you meet in Seattle from here, that's from Fairbanks area here that they would like to hear about?
I haven't met anybody just lately from Fairbanks, except men who come through and had business here at Fairbanks for the government, like Bob Summers. Bob Summers has really made his home in Juneau, but he built this airfield at Galena, and the one at Moses Point, and the one at Nome. He had been an old government man years before that, in charge of roads. That is the government man, not the Alaska Road Commission, but the government end of it, the federal government.
Department of Interior.
Yes, the Department of Interior. There was Bob Florey and different ones in Juneau at that time, who had jobs that are now under the state of different names and different categories. So the Secretary of State is a new official performing the same functions as the Surveyor General and Secretary of Alaska performed. And then there's another man here in Fairbanks that's head of the miners organization, Harry Watson.
Harry Watson, yeah.
Well, Harry Watson, after he went over to Juneau, as far as I know, he was in Anchorage as Secretary of the Miners Association. And I don't know what become of Harry. I haven't seen him lately, but he must be around Alaska.
Did you, by chance, come in over Skagway and Chilkoot Pass at any time you traveled?
Yeah, I came over the railroad, but not over the pass on foot.
You come up the Copper River Railroad?
I came over, no, not the Copper River Railroad, the White Pass
and
Yukon.
White Pass Yukon Railroad.
Yeah, see, that was built in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
So that saved a lot of that foot travel.
Did
over
you travel by boat across the lake?
I built my own boat.
Oh, you built your own boat?
Built my own boat at four of us. Built a boat, and we came down from Lake Bennett into the Yukon waters, then waited for the breakup. We pulled our boat across Lake LaBarge, and then put our boat in water when the ice went out, and floated down to Dawson. Did that in order to be in there for the first jobs when the Yukon River boat started out.
Mm-hmm.
See, they laid their boats up, some boats to Dawson, some boats to St. Michael.
Mm-hmm.
So when the ice was out, the boat would start from Dawson down the river, and the boat was started from St. Michael up the river.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for three different years. And same companions on two of the trips, young Shorty Armstrong and Guy Wilson and Algie Lauren and myself, the same four, did that for three different years.
Mm-hmm.
And we did walk over the railroad, though, to save that $20 the first time. But the second time, we had enough money to make the ride when we knew what the walk meant. But the first time we did walk over the railroad.
That was tough walking.
Well, in the sense it wasn't. It was a distance of maybe 60 miles. I don't recall the mileage.
Nothing too far.
No, not too far.
Mm-hmm.
And the weather was good, you know, in late May like it is now.
Mm-hmm.
See, and that's about, I'd say, the best part of the year. Of course, the ice sometimes because out on different dates. I don't know what the earliest is or the latest, but it's a variation there of almost a month.
Well, what characters do you remember living along that would be of interest? Had business along there?
Yes, a fellow at a place called Tantalus was at a coal mine, and I think his name was, begin with a C anyhow, Codfinch or some name like that, and he was quite a character. He had come down as we arrived, and he always had, the first thing he wanted to offer was tobacco, you know, to buy from him.
Yeah.
He just had a small tent there that he had some supplies, so the fellows coming down their own small boat, well, I'd just pull up there and get a little refreshment and maybe buy some tea or whatever things you might need of. But as a rule, we provisioned our boat before we left Lake Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You build a boat at Lake Bennett from whipsawed lumber. See, the men were there, and they whipsaw the lumber for you, and they help you to build a boat.
Dan, do you have...
That boat cost us $20.
Just $20?
$20.
Do you happen to remember old Captain A.J. Goddard?
Yes, I knew Captain Goddard quite well. Captain Goddard was one of the big men on the... As far as one of the riverboat members concerned, Captain Goddard was one of the best known men.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Captain Goddard, and he was over in the Kusker Krim for a while too, doing some experimental work on the Kusker Krim. He and Captain Young, as another Captain Young. Then there was a Captain Bledsoe.
Bledsoe, yeah.
Yeah, name like the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Bledsoe, you know, it's in verse by ex-Secretary of State John Hay.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote this book about the ship burning up, and he'll hose the nozzle and get to bank to the last glutes ashore, and mention a man named Bledsoe as the skipper.
Mm-hmm.
And this Bledsoe might have been of that family. They're all ex-Mississippi River men, you know.
Mm-hmm.
See, Captain Orrin Newcomb was a Mississippi River man. Captain Looney, Captain Sam Lancaster, and Captain Young, and others of them, of course, broke in on the river here. And they had experience maybe on the Columbia River or something like that, because most all these western rivers had sternwheel boats. Even some of the Skagit River in Seattle had a sternwheel by the name called a Harvest Queen, and another one called a Skagit Queen. So sternwheel boats were river boats at that time. I made a trip myself one time from St. Louis to New Orleans on a boat called the Minnie Adams, and the steamer Susie was practically a replica of the Minnie Adams model.
It's a duplicate.
Same type of boat, two stacker.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the story? The two Swedes went on top of the mountain and made the rich discovery over Dawson?
Well, I've heard of it, but I don't know
that.
No, that's one of the stories. You can't account for the authenticity of a lot of those old stories. But it went that they were in the bar, you know, and having a drink, and they asked the bartender where they should go to stake a claim. He said, well, right up there, and points up on the dome, you know. So they went, and by God, they did strike it on the dome. So that might be an authentic story.
I heard that in Seattle years ago.
Yeah, that's what I say. I've heard the same story, but I couldn't vouch for the authenticity of it. But there has been lots of claims made that way, you know, just by luck and a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Bartender or someone telling them to go out this creek and you'll strike it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And by God, they did.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a number of cases of that kind. Now, we had an old prospector on the Custer Quim used to come over on the Yukon side. His name was Barnhart. He wore a big heavy beard. But his story was somewhat similar. He came in there as kind of what we call a chichaka, like they call these little boats. They're talking about building them, we call them chichaka boats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you build your own little flat bottom boat.
Mm-hmm.
But this fellow Barnhart, they told him to go over on the Kuskokwim, don't mind the Yukon Basin. You'll strike it rich if you go over so and so. So he took that advice, and there was a portage up from Shagalov Slough, where the town of Dykeman would be, and the Iditarod country, or a portage, they call it, only a few miles from between the Yukon and the Kuskokwim. And he did go over and prospect the Kuskokwim and struck it rich.
Mm-hmm.
And I met that man personally. He used to come over and travel down to St. Michael to take the boat to go outside, because there's no transportation from the Kuskokwim.
Were they building that telegraph line after you went through that country?
No, that was all gone years ago, because they did have they went as far as St. Michael, putting up some of the poles. They came across the Stickeen River, what they call this place up in the Stickeen there, Telegraph Creek, after that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that was all previous. That was 50 years before the gold strikes up here.
Oh, that was earlier, yeah.
Oh, yes, that was the way when they laid the Atlantic cable. Well, naturally, that killed the idea of a telegraph line across the Bering Strait to go into Europe by land. because the Bering Strait was the nearest place to go, and made a long cable line across all Alaska and British Columbia to cross over
to
Siberia.
They
planned to cross the Bering Sea and across to Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
That was the plan. But the laying of the Alaskan cable just stopped all work because there's no necessity for it then. The investors in that took big losses, you know. No, that's a matter of American history. You get that fact from your history book.
Well, Captain Goddard and his wife told me some of those things about the telegraph line, and they took 4,000 pictures while they were there, and when they passed away, they willed them to the Smithsonian Institution.
Well, I wouldn't wonder, because Captain Goddard was a pretty generous man, and of course, he gets the, you might say, the original plan of Fairbanks, to lay out Fairbanks. Of course, he could have landed his boat further down the river, but he proceeded to come up to Fairbanks and land his supplies here.
Captain Burnett, you mean?
Yes, so mm-hmm. Captain Burnett, Goddard was associated with him.
Well, he was associated.
Yes,
that's
associated.
That's the thing that I haven't been able to tie together.
Yes, he was associated with Captain Burnett. But I didn't know Captain Burnett personally. I don't ever recall meeting him. But I did meet Captain Goddard on several occasions.
I have a picture of him and I together and taken in Seattle before he passed away.
Yes, I remember Captain Goddard quite well. And I identify him with, you might say, the development of this part of Alaska. And the MC Company deserves a great deal of credit for that. Because in late years, while there might have been some opposition, you know, from a public utility company owning the water works and the gas and the central heating plant and all the public utilities, there came a little controversial late years. But on the other hand, you got to give them credit for helping to build up the country because they gave credit to hundreds of men. They dished it out hand over fist. That's the old Sloss people.
Mm-hmm.
After the Sloss people got out and Valley Richmond reformed the company, they tried to maintain the same policy, but they didn't have the wealth and the money behind them that the Sloss people had.
See, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars there that they had out.
There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it. I'd be in some of their stores along the river and see these fellas coming in with big beards on them, and they want a steam hose, or they want a boiler, or they wanted some little thing, and mark it on the books, send them out as a prospect, and they sign an agreement. If they didn't discover anything, of course, as they had a name for it. What do you call that again when a man stakes another?
Grubstake.
Grubstake.
Mm-hmm.
They had a grubstake claim.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of them never came in with any claim.
That's right.
But some of them maybe did, I wouldn't know.
Well,
the MC Company handled lots of gold over their counter.
Mm-hmm.
They had the regular weighing scale, gold scale,
all
that sort of thing. Yes, they took charge of the gold, mm-hmm. and lots of times going down the river, I'd find them with gold in their suitcase or something and put it in my room
mm-hmm.
to take care of it. And shipments were made, bulk gold in cases, you know, just laid out on deck.
That's right.
And in fact, there was one big case here. I think the waiters involved were named Miller. And they took some of this box of gold off the deck of the boat and they threw it overboard in some shallow place where they could come and claim it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a mystery, whatever became of that gold. It'd be in the Fairbanks papers years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know the Miller boys personally. It happened too before my time in that sense. But after a couple of years, they went and by God, they must have claimed this gold and they got spending around Fairbanks. And then they want to know where this gold come from, and they finally uncovered it. They stole this gold.
Stole it off the boat?
Yeah.
Threw it overboard.
Just threw it overboard.
Got it.
Yeah. Because
mm-hmm.
there was no special care taken of these gold shipments.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much.
They didn't use the lock thing.